Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As the world watches an unprovoked invasion in Ukraine intensifying as Russian forces attack cities and encroach on the capital of Kyiv, in Sacramento County, a large Ukrainian community is watching a personal war unfold from thousands of miles away. Many with loved ones, some fleeing as refugees, others staying behind to fight, and the sobering reality of loved ones being killed or with unknown whereabouts. It is stressful, painful times like these where many people turn to faith to stand shoulder to shoulder with a community navigating grave moments of helplessness. Edward Kislyanka is the senior pastor at House of Bread Church in Sacramento County, which serves the Slavic community. Pastor Kislyanka, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
I visited your church this weekend in support of a Ukrainian friend and was just struck by the large community you serve. You have services in both Russian and English, as well as a campus full of a variety of resources, including a cafe with traditional Slavic delicacies. Pastor Kislyanka, do you have an idea of how many people you serve in Sacramento?
In Sacramento, we serve about 2,000 people. That's the number inside of Sacramento, but we have a large international presence as a church.
Yeah. The war just started before Sunday service. Many people in our community are now learning that there is a sizable Ukrainian community here in our backyard. What should they keep at top of mind about the community that you serve?
That, you know, Sacramento has about 200,000. Those are the numbers. The Sacramento area has about 200,000 Slavic people. Now that's shifted during the coronavirus. People have moved around and moved away. But 70%, that's the estimate that most of us hold, are Ukrainian. And 30% are Belarusian and Russian. And so we have mostly a Ukrainian population, and about 30,000 out of those numbers go to church. And so we have a lot of people that are different, that are diverse, of faith, that don't have faith. The other thing is that in the last 8 years, since 2014, Sacramento has grown drastically with refugees that have come because of the beginning of this war. There are people right now that are flooding, especially through Mexico, illegally into the country. And a lot of them are ending up in Sacramento because of the population that's already here.
Yeah.
And so there's a diverse group of people that have been gathering for 30 years in this region.
And you're talking in 2014 with the illegal annexation of Crimea in Ukraine's southern peninsula. You are fielding so many personal stories and worries from Ukrainians who are in constant communication with loved ones in their home country. What can you share with us? What are you hearing?
Ukraine, I mean, all the stories, they break down kind of into categories, to be honest, because Ukraine is having there's kind of different regions. There's the war-torn area, and we're hearing stories. Obviously, people are reaching out every day. I mean, we have thousands of messages, phone calls, emails, where people are calling from those areas and going, hey, can you guys get supplies to us? And crying out for that kind of help all the way to people that are in Sacramento. But there's no way to get to them because they're surrounded. It's dangerous. Trucks are not allowed. Anybody that does go in and out of those cities, they're going under the risk of gunfire. And at the same time, having to navigate the martial law, you know, 6 p.m. curfews, which makes it pretty much impossible. So the people that are in those areas are stuck. And so their help is more of, hey, is there any way to get more supplies here? Because we're running out, especially medical supplies, the basic necessities. The second group of people are the people that are more in the western part of the country. So there's been a great migration, obviously, of refugees in and around the country. And the western part of the country, where there are no tanks, you know, especially the northwest, in the Lviv area, people are everybody's become almost like an impromptu shelter for refugees from the central and eastern part of Ukraine. And so once again, the system is completely strained, and their people are running out of supplies, and they're trying to figure out how to house refugees. Every church that we're talking to, we're trying to support the churches, because they've become almost like the only organized communities where people are flocking to. There's some level of trust there, and so people are flocking there, and they're filling up the basements, the pews. And most of these pastors had zero preparation to be able to handle anything like this. And so, you know, in the beginning, they were asking for mattresses. We have, you know, it's the middle of winter, and we get mattresses. So there's that kind of an issue. And then you have the border, and the border is, you know, what everybody describes. You know, we had somebody from our church who actually, we had a bunch of people from our church who actually had to navigate the process of getting across the border. And the last one was a few days ago, about 2 days ago, a woman with her children, because her husband was not allowed to go. A woman with her children was crossing it. And they described living hell conditions on this side of the border in Ukraine. It is a very difficult process, which I can go into detail to show what it is. But the hardest part of that process, the refugee process, is not getting out of the country and trying to find something. The Polish government, the Romanian, people, and the Moldovan people are wonderful, and they're meeting the need. They're prepared. They're resourced. But this side, just to get to the border, even in a relatively peaceful part of Ukraine, relatively speaking, is living hell. People are arriving at checkpoints about 30 kilometers from the border, and they're separated from their husbands. And only the women, children, and the elderly are allowed to move on. Anybody between ages 18 and 60 is separated and told to stay. They have to stay for their country. And the women move on, and a lot of them are on foot. So they're walking from that point 30 kilometers with kids just to get to the border. Once they arrive at the border, the wait times are 30 to 36 hours. We have not heard anybody having less than 30 hours of trying to just get across the border. And in that time, there is nothing set up. There are no bathrooms. There's no food. There's no water. There's no medical assistance, unless literally somebody is, you know, loses consciousness. There's nowhere to sit. It's disorderly. And, people are being mugged. This is the reality of the situation, that, you know, the kind of the evil side of certain people does not disappear even with war, even if their own are being attacked. People are carrying their life savings on them. And for 30 hours, it's literally a war zone within a war zone. People just trying to get to the border. And the border control, you know, some of them are wonderful. Some of them were the most corrupt people to begin with. And so that hasn't changed. And so most people that I'm talking to in my family, for example, want to get to Poland, but they don't want to go through this experience because of, you know, social media and the access to information. People are getting details, you know, in real time about the experience. And so a lot of people, like my family, is sitting still, and they're not even, you know, they would prefer to sit there than go through that experience.
Yeah. When you say 30 kilometers, that's over 18 miles. And they're walking that. Where's your family located in Ukraine?
So I have family all over, but most of them right now, some of them are in Kyiv, but most of them, the people that we know, but the family, most of them are in the western Ukraine, not far from the border.
Do they have any level of safety? I mean, how are they feeling? Like, you're in constant communication with them.
So anybody who could get out of the city into villages, they do that because it seems safer, because obviously any, you know, missile attacks have always been somewhere near a city. All the airfields are usually around cities. And so the villages seem calmer, safer, a little more sane. And a lot of people at least have, you know, food that they grow and all that. And they have some level of resources that are available. So they sit there.
You have fellow pastors that have chosen to stay behind instead of coming back to the United States. They stayed behind at the Ukrainian border to help with support and resources. What are they seeing when those individuals finally get to cross the border and need help?
So in the beginning, right now, the outpouring of support from especially the Polish government, you know, if you look at the Polish crossings, it is very organized. The spirit of the Polish people is very welcoming. And so that's been an amazing thing. On the flip side, one of the things that they're seeing right now is, you know, once again, because of the social media and how information gets across, whether it's verified or not, there's some trafficking that's happening. I want to remind people that it's women and children crossing the border by themselves, and they're coming into an area. They might have connections somewhere in Spain, somewhere in Italy, maybe somebody in Poland. But the point is, when they get across the border, there's a lot of resources there, but a lot of them are becoming afraid. You know, we had those pastors were actually at the border this last night. They were there for 14 hours serving and passing out food and you know, and just speaking in Ukrainian, because there's a lot of mistrust, because there have been some people who've been trafficked and nobody knows that, nobody can fully verify it, but the information's out there and everybody hears it. And so, you know, they said that they've watched some people walk right past the people that are trying to offer resources just because they don't speak Ukrainian and they're afraid. And they walk past until literally somebody has to grab them and go, well, where are you going? So that's kind of, there's a lot of fear and mistrust on both sides right now of the border.
Yeah, that's understandable. Your church is mounting more support to send to Ukraine to help. What is currently in the works?
So we are trying to meet the need, not the perceived need. And so we're very careful in how we're operating because, for example, you know, we have a lot of people that are gathering supplies from here and sending that out. We're doing that as well. But because we have people that are right there at the border and in, you know, the major cities there in Poland, some of the things that people think are needed, they're not really needed anymore. The Polish government did a great job collecting it and providing it to the people that are in need. The biggest need right now in Ukraine is for medical supplies, basic medical supplies. Not only is Ukraine pretty much out of that stuff, and we're not talking militarily, we're talking military and civilian populations are affected by this. There's no medical, you know, supplies, their stockpiles are almost out. And even in Poland, our pastors wanted to secure supplies, and they can't. There's nothing there, not even in Poland. The basics, if you try to go anywhere to where you could get that stuff or anywhere where you can have it, even in bulk quantities, there's nothing there. And so what we're doing is we've been working with a lot of the providers here in the U.S., people who are responsible for supplying hospitals, and the outpouring of support has been incredible. We're gathering that, and we're working and coordinating to get that to Ukraine, to Poland in the next few days, because even there you can't really find it. So that's what we're doing. And then the second thing is, like I mentioned, in Ukraine, a lot of the churches have become kind of the only network of organized refugee centers, if you will, to help people in the country. And so we are trying to raise funds, and we are funding, we're having to verify churches through our network, and sending money to those pastors, because that's the only real way right now to get anything into Ukraine and help where the need is. As I mentioned, there's a lot of good resources once you get into Poland, once you get into these other countries. But within Ukraine, it's extremely limited. There, you're not allowed to bring a truck over the border with humanitarian aid. Everything's through vans. It's reloaded. Some people may have some sort of access because they know somebody to, you know, pay that they can bring, you know, something more in qualities. But we have to, we're more focusing on helping from within by resourcing the pastors that are there, and who have access to any type of aid. To be able to purchase that for the people that they're serving.
When it comes to medical supplies, and you're coordinating with people here in the United States to get it to Ukraine, because there are a lot of resources available on the other side of the border, logistically, how do you get these supplies to Ukraine?
Yeah, that's the hardest thing. I mean, there's almost like a five-step logistical nightmare that you have to navigate. There's a supply side, which that one's not that hard. The American people, I mean, this country has always been extremely generous, and And so that part is okay, but getting it across is the hardest thing. There are resources out there with freight forwarding. There are resources companies. There's a, you know, contacts within the government that help with that. And there are cargo planes that get hired out, chartered out in order to be able to bring that across. The easiest way is to just send containers by ship, but that just takes way too long. And so most of it is we're focusing on getting it across through the air. And then, you know, having to receive it there. I mean, we've rented warehouses in Poland near the airports, forklifts, getting vehicles there to get this stuff from the airport to the border. The Ukrainian government and the Polish government work pretty well with opening the border for humanitarian aid, but depending on what it is and in what quantities. And so we're having to work with bulk in order to be able to be effective.
Before we let you go, for people who are listening and they've been wanting to help, but they don't know how and they don't know which organizations to trust, what advice do you have to give?
I would just go with the ones that everybody knows about. There's Samaritan's Purse. There's the Convoy of Hope. Those two are amazing. There's the Red Cross. You know, I can recommend us, but I would not. Nobody, you know, if you don't know us, give to the ones that you know and the ones that have a good reputation. There's ways you can search that on Google and to see which organizations have a reputation, how much percentage of their, you know, their intake goes to expenses of, you know, operations versus to the people that actually need it. And so give to those organizations and you'll be pretty safe.
Pastor Kislyanka, I know you are so busy. Thank you so much for just taking the time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Edward Kislyanka is the senior pastor at House of Red Church in Sacramento County, which serves the greater Slavic community. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. It is easy to get caught up in the speed of what's happening in the world. Just a week ago, we learned Russian troops are going to invade Ukraine, a war the likes of which has not happened since World War II. As of this morning, more than 1 million people have fled the country, and the UN Refugee Agency predicts that number may grow to 4 million. But this also serves as a reminder that times of crises are not immune from discrimination. In the initial days of the exodus, reports surfaced that racist, discriminatory practices were taking place for refugees at the Ukrainian border. And we really don't need to go that far back to remember controversy surrounding dire situations and atrocities taking place across the world and here at home. So we're going to slow down and use Ukraine as a teaching moment about how we collectively treat others. Kevin Johnson is the dean of UC Davis Law and professor of public interest law and Chicano studies. Professor Johnson joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks very much for having me.
Professor Johnson, you have been keeping abreast of refugees fleeing Ukraine, but in the spirit of this being a teachable moment, what stands out to you?
Well, at this moment, we are seeing a large flow of hundreds of thousands, maybe up to a million people fleeing a war-torn Ukraine. And there are many, unfortunately, many instances like this where there's widespread numbers of refugees fleeing violence. Sometimes it's war, sometimes it's civil war, sometimes it's mass violence, sometimes it's starvation. Sometimes it's natural disaster. But in this instance, one of the things that I think is relatively good is the world support for the Ukrainian refugees and the stated support and the adherence to important international instruments that require nations to provide sanctuary to refugees fleeing violence. So that part is good. I do worry a little bit because we have a nation, Ukraine, of approximately 44 million people. The war, if it continues, there'll be more refugees fleeing the country. And the European Union often exhibits compassion fatigue when there are large numbers of migrants seeking to come in. So I'm hopeful that the generosity of Europe continues, particularly Poland. And it's hard, though, if the numbers continue to increase.
Well, on that note, what is the EU's record of admitting refugees?
Well, the EU is an interesting entity. The European Union allows for free migration within Europe and has created what some have called the fortress Europe surrounding Europe. And over time, the EU has had a mixed record when it comes to refugee admissions. In 2015, a fairly significant number of Syrians fled war-torn Syria, mass violence, mass death, horrible atrocities. And the EU, in the eyes of many, was not as open and sympathetic to the Syrian refugees as it should have been under international law and as compassion would dictate. So it's varied over time. And I think that these kinds of large numbers of people always test a nation's resolve and a region's resolve. I guess I would say that in some respects, the United States is not always the example for the world in the way that it treats refugees and asylum seekers as well. So we all can be subject to criticism at various points in time.
When looking at the Syrian war, which began in 2011, it is still ongoing. According to the Associated Press, it remains the largest refugee crisis, nearly 5.7 million people. But what I learned is that it took at least 3 months for 1 million refugees to leave Syria. We're talking less than a week for Ukraine. Can you just lay out the differences in how the European Union and its countries responded to these different refugee crises?
I think that the European Union and the nations within it, including Poland, were worried about a mass migrations of Muslims into their territory and slowed down the admissions and made it more difficult for refugee admissions. And I think at some level, religion played into it, the fact that they were Muslims. I think that the perception that they were people of color and different than the people within the country factored into it as well. And I think that the sympathy exhibited by some nations in the EU wasn't as great as the sympathy is now being expressed toward the Ukrainians. And some of the press reports have talked to political leaders in Europe saying that those people are like us, I see us in them. And that's not the kind of talk that was afforded to the Syrian refugees, who are viewed as culturally, religiously, racially different. And sadly enough, in my view, sometimes those kinds of factors influence the the reception given to refugees. And I think that there are some strong elements in Poland, for example, that resist Muslim migration into Poland. And there are some claims that came from ABC News yesterday people from Africa and who appeared Arab were being discriminated against by right-wing groups in Poland after they crossed the border. So I think that this is a complex migration issue. And we're going to be working through it for a good period of time. At this moment, we're dealing with a situation where it appears that students at universities from Africa and India are not being allowed to leave Ukraine as easily as native Ukrainians. There's been claims that they haven't been permitted on trains and buses to exit the country. That's unfortunate, my view, and inconsistent with international law as well. But hopefully those students will be able to get out of the country.
When we learned of that, that was going to be my next point, learning that, you know, Ukraine is actually home to a large international student population. And then there were reports that foreign students from India and other parts of Asia and Africa were being denied access to cross. That was surprising to a lot of people. But was it surprising to you?
The short answer is no. It's sad, but racism, unfortunately, influences response to migrants around the world, in this nation and as well as other nations as well. The Fortress Europe is designed to keep people from Africa from coming into Europe. And Spain was forced to pass its first immigration law to try to stop migration from Africa into the European Union. So I'm not surprised. I hope in the end that our better angels prevail. And that we treat all people similarly situated fleeing a horrific invasion of military and allow them to leave the country, just as I would hope in the future when Syrians are fleeing, military conflict and chemical warfare, that they're permitted to leave the country as well. It's in some ways it's uplifting the treatment of Ukrainian refugees. I think that we should think carefully how we make sure that all refugees who are similarly situated are similarly treated.
It seems like in chaotic situations like these, where you have huge waves of people fleeing violence, that these are moments where we're forced to make choices and we get to see who is valued more than others.
Or we get to see who we value as a nation,
right,
and other nations. And we learn a lot about ourselves and what we are as a nation. And to talk about the United States, we hold ourselves out as a nation that embraces the huddled masses. At the same time, we've made it very difficult through a number of administrations for Central Americans fleeing horrible violence. Maybe it's not the same as the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians, but it's still horrible violence, economic deprivation, and we've taken some dramatic steps that I think are difficult to square with international law, and make it harder for some people to sleep at night. So I think that we should think carefully in trying to treat people humanely. And also thinking about what does it tell about us as a nation if we turn our backs on people in need? Mm-hmm. We often look back at the United States' failure to give refuge to the SS St. Louis during World War II, which was filled with Jewish people fleeing Nazi Germany. We did not provide them relief. They were returned. Many didn't make it. And that's a stain in our national consciousness. And I would hope that we in the future don't repeat those kinds of things. And I hope that Europe and Poland right now, which appears to be responding admirably to the Ukrainian refugee influx, continues to do so in the future.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Kevin Johnson, the dean of UC Davis Law, about reports of discrimination and racism amid the Ukrainian refugee crisis. That does bring me to the United States, because this is an opportunity to take a hard look at practices here. We only need to really look back to August during the U.S. withdrawal of Afghanistan and the desperation of people trying to flee that country under Taliban rule. Are there parallels to draw from this?
No, I think that we as a nation have some work to do to humanely and legally treat refugees. Many Afghani citizens who assisted the U.S. military through interpreting and others aren't able to come to this country, had their visas being processed incredibly slowly given the urgency of their conditions. And now it appears have been instructed by the Taliban government that they can't leave the country. And these are people who assisted Americans, the most favored, perhaps, of the refugees from Afghanistan who can't make it here. We have increased the numbers of Afghani refugees that we've been willing to admit. But now that seems to be a distant part of our memory, and it's not nearly as urgent as it once was. It seems to me that we really should focus on making it easier as opposed to harder to have those refugees come to the United States. Unfortunately, and there's a big transition in the federal government in coming around right now, is that for 4 years, the Trump administration was making it more difficult for people from any nation, literally, but particularly Muslims and people from Mexico and Central America to come to this country. That's really slowed down the flow of people, has tightened labor markets, has made it more difficult for people to reunite with family, to flee horrible conditions. And it will take some time for this new administration to reopen things and to make the immigration flow of people more consistent with what's been in previous administrations. So I don't want to be unduly condemn the current administration. I think there's work to be done. And I think it's important to remember that we as a nation have not always lived up to our word in terms of humane treatment of refugees, asylum seekers, and immigrants.
Yeah, and the Biden administration has come under fire and criticism. Even former President Obama has been called deporter in chief. And specifically, when it comes to the Biden administration, we can expand this to the record number of Haitians seeking asylum in Mexico. There are reports from even just a little over a month ago that they are indefinitely stranded, facing racism and discrimination. And we've seen them even reach the southern border and really just deplorable treatment that we've seen those images.
Yeah, and those images are as disturbing as I can imagine. Made me literally want to cry when I saw Border Patrol officers on horseback chasing down black men, black Haitians along the U.S.-Mexico border. We have to remember that people who flee their native countries, they do so oftentimes out of desperation and the lack of hope where they stay. And we should remember that they're people, they're humans. They're not nameless aliens who deserve to be poorly treated, placed in detention, rounded up by horseback, deported where they came from. And I fear that sometimes the coarseness of the discussion of immigrants leads to very harsh treatment of immigrants. And we historically have been, I think, overly tough in terms of admission of Haitian migrants. I think part of that is their poverty. It's a very poor country. And part of it also is their race. And we should be better than that. And we should think carefully about how to humanely treat people in dire circumstances. We shouldn't denigrate them. And sometimes the terms of the immigration debate are troubling. We had a president a few years ago who talked about Salvadorans and Haitians as coming from S-hole countries. And he talked about Mexicans as criminals and rapists. That's not going to help us have a rational discussion about how to humanely treat people in dire circumstances. And so I do hope, and I know it's sometimes frightening when there's the specter of large number of people coming here, including people who are culturally and racially and otherwise different. But we still need to have a rational discussion as opposed to reflex reactions where we just try to close the borders and keep people out. We say we're better than that, and we should live up to being better than that.
Yeah. Given your background as information professor, you know, specifically that of the southern border, I mean, we have to be reminded of the exodus, as you were just touching upon, of largely Central Americans during this time. I worked in McAllen on the border, the Texas-Mexico border, and people die in really deplorable, desolate conditions along the Rio Grande.
No, our border enforcement measures that really started ramping up in the 1990s in operations like Operation Gatekeeper near San Diego and a number of others have made it more difficult to migrate unlawfully through large cities and have redirected migrants through deserts and mountains, and people die on a regular basis. We get a death a day, of at least a death a day. Those are ones we know about along the border. People who are fleeing horrible conditions. Sometimes it's gang violence, sometimes it's domestic violence, sometimes it's severe economic deprivation, but they're willing to risk it all to risk their lives to come to the United States. And we're redirecting to places where we know people are going to die. And it's so common, and it happens so regularly that it's not even news along the border. It's part of daily life along the border. And in the summer in southern Arizona, for example, they don't have enough spaces in the morgues to keep all the bodies and that accumulate over time. So I think you're precisely right, and I think we should think more carefully about the inhumanity that our current border policies promote. And we know what's happening. It happens on a regular basis. We can't say it's unintended at that point.
Yeah. Before we let you go, at the core of this are human beings seeking safety. What do you come back to be reminded of humanity? Because it can get
Well,
lost.
yeah, no, I we have an immigration clinic at UC Davis School of Law, and I work with some of the students, not all the time, but some of the time. And when you go to a session where you inform people about their rights or under the immigration laws, and you talk to people who are just scared about being arrested by immigration authorities, they go to church, they take their children to school, or they go to the doctors who are crying because they can't get relief because they want to get legal and they don't know how to. It always reminds me that it's flesh and blood and real people who are being affected by our laws and their enforcement. And it's not faceless illegal aliens who are all criminals and rapists who want to injure our country. They're people who live and work in our communities, who go to churches with us, who attend our schools, and who are part of our communities, whether they're here lawfully or not.
Kevin Johnson is the Dean of UC Davis Law. Appreciate the time. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The times we are living in can understandably feel heavy and overwhelming. It's important to hit pause, take a breath, and a break. If you're inspired to be amused, educated, and entertained, the Sacramento Jewish Film Festival promises to have something for everyone this year. The film festival just kicked off its 23rd year with a wide-ranging selection of feature-length to short films from all over the world, including Ukraine. We are always happy to have the festival join us to talk about the festival happenings and how you can make the most of it. Joining us today are Willie Recht, CEO of the Jewish Federation of the Sacramento Region, along with Jessica Braverman Birch and Tevin Laxer, the director of the Sacramento Jewish Film Festival. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We appreciate being on.
Yeah, I appreciate having you and joining us, you know, each year. You know, Willie, starting with you, you're the CEO of the Jewish Federation of the Sacramento Region. Can you talk about some of the parallels or connections between the festival and really the events that are happening around the world right now?
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. This has been an incredibly touching and important show. I've been listening this morning. I think you sort of brought a piece to it in the introduction about the pause and the importance of that pause, but also not forgetting what's going on. I mean, what's going on in Ukraine is incredibly important to the Jewish community. There's still over 200,000 Jews in Ukraine. There were, of course, many, many more prior to World War II and the Holocaust. But this is an important cause, and it's important between, you know, our federation and the 148 federations across the country, and have opened up an emergency fund, you know, raising almost $8 million in less than a week. And it happens to be that we have a film that Tevin will talk about, you know, about Ukraine. And so this is a subject that is very much close to home and something that we hold near and dear to our hearts and keep in our thoughts and prayers as well.
Tevin, this is the 23rd year. How has the importance of the Jewish Film Festival evolved for the Sacramento community?
Thank you for having us. And I want to say that the three segments are rather connected, given that you'll hear about a film from Ukraine shortly. And, you know, I also want to say that, you know, we are streaming again this year. We were streaming all of last year. We, like other festivals, really hope to go back to real theaters soon. We will be at a theater March 20th, as I'll also talk about. But, you know, as you said in your intro, we are open to all film lovers from all over Northern California. We hope to bring the community films that inspire, films with artistic value, educational content, and we like to entertain. We miss being at the Crest, where we also can have live music, dancing, and food, but people will have to have food and dancing in their own homes.
And that's an easy thing to do. Jessica, when it comes to the Jewish Film Festival, someone may think, look, well, I'm not really religious or I'm not Jewish. How would this appeal to those who don't belong to the Jewish community?
That's a really good question. I always reach out to, you know, friends, Jewish and non-Jewish, and tell them that we have such an important breadth of films. As Tevin mentioned, you know, genres and from 17 countries, and you know, we have just such a breadth of films and short films, and I think that there are lots and lots of our films that everybody would appeal to everybody. There is actually saw a film yesterday. I'll just briefly mention that it's for anybody who's interested in sports, but also in history. It talked about this gentleman, Marty Glickman, who many people don't know. If you lived on the East Coast, you would know him. But Marty Glickman was an athlete and was supposed to perform in the 1936 Olympics, ended up not because of politics and anti-Semitism at the time, but he went on to be one of the most famous sportscasters in history and helped start HBO Sports. So there's a lot we have, I think, and a lot of learning and joy. And so I encourage everybody to log on and see.
Well, each of you have selected a film that you want to profile. So let's get to it. Tevin, tell us about the film Song Searcher.
Sure, thank you. It's also very personal to me since my grandfather was born in Ukraine, born in college, which is in Western Ukraine. He lost at least 17 family members in the Holocaust. So this film is a documentary about someone, you know, just like Jessica said about Marty Glickman, this film profiles someone that's little known as well, but was very important. His name is Moshe Beregovsky. And he was a musicologist, a scholar. He traveled throughout Ukraine from 1929 to 1947. And he recorded the traditional music of Ukrainian Jews. He recorded them on fragile wax cylinders, and he's literally over 2,000 recordings were made, essentially preserving centuries of Jewish culture, tradition, and songs. The film also depicts the destruction of Jewish life by both the Nazis and, sadly, the Soviets. Much of the film was both archival and recent footage was in Kyiv. I also want to mention for people listening, Kyiv is the Ukrainian pronunciation. Kiev is the Russian pronunciation. So we're now using Kyiv. Sadly, 81 years ago, almost to the day, Nazis bombed Kyiv. Sorry, Kyiv. Boy, I go back. It's hard to keep saying Kyiv.
It is.
But 1941, the Nazis bombed Kyiv and occupied the country. And sadly now, the Russians are bombing Kyiv and surrounding territory. I've seen the film twice now. I wonder how much of what I've seen will still be standing after this violence ends. Song Searcher will be streaming from March 8th through March 14th. And before we move on to the second film,
Yes, we're actually going to play that music clip that you were going to mention at to end our show. I want to make sure we can get to Jessica and Willie before we wrap up. Willie,
thank you.
You are very welcome. Willie, the next film that you want to talk about is Tree of Life. This was the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in American history.
Yeah, I was going to talk about this, and I feel fortunate that we get to show this film, you know, a documentary about the horrific 2018 shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And the film exposes and explores the anti-Semitism that led to the shooting and to the community response to the hatred and anti-Semitism. But this was really, you know, even thousands of miles away in Sacramento, we don't work on Shabbat. We have a Shabbat policy, and we don't send emails, we don't hold meetings. And of course, this happened on a Shabbat morning in Pittsburgh. And as we start to know about it, there's only 2 days I can remember that I worked on Shabbat. And this was one of them. And it was so scary here locally. We didn't know what was going on. We communicated with the presidents of the congregations and the rabbis. And I met with the rabbis in my office, I think in our sweats, within hours of finding out. And what are we going to do? We were in contact with law enforcement. And, you know, it was a question of, do we bring the community together? I mean, 11 people just got murdered in a synagogue. What are we going to do? And we decided that we were going to bring the community together. And we worked to plan this. And, I'll expose myself here. It was also happened to be Halloween. And I had promised my husband I would go out with him that night. And so, truth be told, you know, we were in drag, and I went to the party with him. And I spent the whole party outside in drag talking with the mayor and the rabbis, planning a community response. And 2 days later at B'nai Israel, with the help of Rabbi Alfie, we had 1,700 people show up from all across the community, from every denomination, from every religion. It was the most powerful experience I've ever experienced. And I got up and said, I'm scared to be here, but we need to be here. And this is the sort of thing that this film's going to expose and explore. Yeah. And I'm grateful that we get to... that we get to show it at our festival.
And obviously an awful, a deplorable attack, but thank you for painting that visual for us of the lengths you went to on Halloween night. Jessica, we only have about a minute left, but you want to talk about the film, The United States of Tahari.
The United States of Eli Tahari is a wonderful documentary about a famous clothing designer many people know about, but his story is another rags to riches story. He was born in Iran. His family had to flee. He came to the U.S. with less than $100 in his pocket and literally slept on park benches in Central Park. And now he is one of the most famous fashion designers. 50 years later, his brand can be seen in over 40 countries. So we have a live, besides this film, we have a live discussion this coming Sunday at 1 p.m. And we will have the filmmaker and Eli Tahari himself, which is such a really amazing honor. And it will be it'll be moderated by a very well-known store owner in our community, Doris Patel, who owns the Brown House. And Doris has worked in the design and fashion industry for over 40 years, and Brown House has been an institution in Sacramento. So we're very excited about that. And I want to just give a shout out to our sponsor for the film, which is the Hebrew Free Loan Association, which gives interest-free loans to people in need. And so the Rags to Riches story is really something they can relate to. Thank you.
Very cool. Well, you can find out about all of the films and how to buy tickets at sacjewishfilmfest.org. We also have a link to that on our website. Willie Recht is the CEO of the Jewish Federation of the Sacramento Region, along with Jessica Braverman Birch and Tevin Laxer, the director of the Jewish Film Festival. Thank you all for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
So much.
That is it for Inside today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/inside. You can also subscribe to the Inside podcast. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Inside's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday. Here is Tevin's suggestion, Baragoski, from the film that he recommended, which was Song Searcher. Have a great weekend.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.